to James Henry Bedell for that original music developed specifically for Climate Champions. On January 14th, a few hours after PG&E reported that they would be filing for bankruptcy protection, I met with Josh Gerber. It was from Josh that I first heard the term climate change bankruptcy. Josh and I worked together at Sempra Energy until July of 2017, when he founded 33 North Energy to consult with utilities, independent power producers, and energy technology and service providers focused on advanced energy technologies. From regulatory to technical, and from business models to project execution, Josh is a true advanced energy expert. Josh Gerber, welcome to Climate Champions. So you have your own company, 33 North?
33 North Energy, yeah.
North Energy. And we've known each other since 2002. We worked together a long time and I think did some exciting things together. I'm very excited for you that you're out doing, following a path you really are excited to follow.
Likewise.
Like myself, you started out in technology and then found yourself in energy and climate mitigation, ultimately. So can you talk about that journey?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some ways, I guess I drafted right behind you because we were together at the same place at the same time, you know, working on the same things in many cases, trying to, you know, use our background in technology and the sort of, you know, set of tasks that we had in front of us to try and, you know, improve the way that the utility was operating. And I think that, you know, both of us realize and value the, you know, I'll say the virtue in understanding how that affects, you know, what the, you know, the day-to-day, how that day-to-day affects the environment, how it affects, you know, what the company is doing it, how it affects, you know, their impact on the community. So I think that both of us, you know, probably, at least speaking for myself, you know, sort of sought out that connection, I would say, to try and, you know, find more meaning in what we were doing.
And do you have any aha moments, I won't limit you to one, of when you felt yourself shifting from, hey, I've got this technology job, into I had this job to improve the world?
I would say it probably started in 2009 when we first, you know, started the Smart Grid Group at SDG&E, and we really started spending a lot of time with Tom, especially, you know, sort of downloading, you know, his views, his perspective.
Tom Bialik,
yes, his formula and you know, and things like that. He very quickly, I think, provided just a lot of context into, you know, what we were doing day to day, why it was, you know, important, and just sort of the connection that it made back to the system that it was connected to, but ultimately, you know, the business and regulation and, you know, ultimately, you know, how it would be used in the future. So, you know, I would give him a lot of credit and sort of opening my eyes to all that stuff.
So aha moment number one, Tom Bialik shows what is possible. Or shows how things are.
How things are, and sort of just a different way to look at things. You know, sort of look for connections and ways to bridge technology that maybe weren't as obvious to us or to me as they were to him. And I think that's ultimately, you know, what we were there to do, right? Especially me, to maybe to some extent you, was take what we knew about sort of the general world of technology and internet and, you know, IT and enterprise and things like that, and apply that to power systems and to energy systems.
I have a funny story I just remembered.
Okay.
I remember the same day we were buying our Nissan Leafs.
Ooh. Okay.
You don't remember that?
I'm working on it.
Do you remember the serial number?
Mine was like 579 or 571 or something like that.
Mine was 911, but you know, we ordered it the same
751.
Day.
Yeah, yeah.
We were there the same day.
Under 1,000.
You convinced me to turn my purchase into a lease.
Yeah.
You were doing a lease and the guy wouldn't guarantee the car for more than 3 years.
Right.
Wanted to sell me a very expensive policy. So.
Right. Yeah, you were looking at buying extended warranties. I remember that now.
Yeah, it scared me off.
And we talked about how, like, the car was really a computer. And, right? I mean, wasn't that sort of the
early
basic?
Days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did that impact what you're doing now?
Well, you mean the Leaf days?
The Leaf days, I'll take you all the way back to the first aha moment with Tom, through that journey of how you got where you are today.
Well, I mean, started then in 2009, right? Based on the CPUC calendar, we very quickly came up with my first assignment, which was to put together the SDG&E smart grid deployment plan. I mean, that was almost immediately after we formed the group. It was actually right after Terry was leaving. I don't know if you remember that sort of transition, but
I
he was
remember.
sort of going out as I was coming in.
He handed me three presentations he had written and said, "Here's your presentation schedule. Good luck with that." I'm joking. He actually, I think he was at two of those three conferences and kind of coached me through it until I got the hang of it.
Yeah, I think we were in like National Harbor, Washington when we first sort of, we took that first trip. So working on the deployment plan, again, that was sort of a crash course in really understanding how the system worked, how the people at the company thought, how the really entrenched history and culture of the company really guided people before their, sort of objective understanding. In many cases, it was very much on autopilot, and it took us a long time and a lot of convincing, I would say, to get folks to even sort of, listen to us and, think about the ideas that we had very quickly become convinced of. Again, based on, I think largely Tom's advocacy, which was, this could be done. It was being done in a lot of places around the world, and, the basic fundamental pieces were coming together, and
Coming down to price.
coming down in price, and that there were ways to, apply those technologies across different parts of the business and save money through, through reuse, right? Which was something that we very much were on board with from the IT days, right? A lot of the work that I did at SDG&E early on was around service-oriented architectures and reusable software interfaces. I remember those days, right? The web services stuff. That was the first project I had pitched to Debbie Reed. And it was really all about, reliable, open, standards-based integration. And that is very much applicable to what we're talking about with smart grid, grid edge technologies, and the power system.
So you worked on the deployment
Yeah,
plan,
we did that.
and then the journey continues, right? So talk about where you are right now.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, where I'm at right now. So right now, I left SDG&E in 2017, in the middle of the year, for a number of reasons. But I think in general, I was following my original plan. My original plan, actually, was to stay for a pretty short period of time. But, after I had contracted with the company from 2002 to 2003, you told me that I had to either stay or go. And so I took a full-time
Hey,
job
is
there.
a rule.
I know, it's a rule. Yeah, it's the Microsoft temp thing. And I'm really glad that I stayed because, I did get to go through a lot of, really different experiences there and, really, I think, affirmed the type of things that we're talking about here today, which was that technical work that did not have the same kind of, really real-world context. I mean, it just, applying technology and energy is much different, I think, than applying it in a lot of other sectors, just because everybody uses energy. Everybody uses electricity, like, at least in developed countries like ourselves. It's something that is, universal. It's understandable by nearly everybody. Even if they don't really understand how, where electricity comes from, they understand that they use it, and they understand that they're paying a bill, and they understand, some of the basics of, how wires work, right? Because they plug things into the wall, and they can start putting those, those things together a little bit. And so, made it really meaningful, which is why I stayed with it so long, and which is why when I left, I decided to, stay committed to, an energy track. I would say that I was fortunate enough to have a lot of opportunities at SDG&E to, have some really good project successes, some of which were more maybe obvious than others. The deployment plan to me was really interesting because it helped me understand how things worked. It helped me understand how the company ran, and helped me understand sort of the connection between policy and technology and the enterprise. So I may have gotten a lot more out of it than everybody else did, but I think that it helped commit me to, you know, sticking with it for that period of time. And so, you know, as I've been out on my own doing consulting work, I've been primarily working, again, with California Utilities, but really around vehicle to grid for the most part in the last year and a half. Because I've done so much work with energy storage when I was at SDG&E and, you know, sort of smart grid and grid edge technology in general. You did at a time have the clean transportation group in our department, but I never actually worked within it. And that's really sort of the intersection that I'm working at right now with vehicle to grid and, you know, using electric vehicles just not just as loads, but as storage.
You mentioned a big success being the deployment plan, and I totally get that. It was soup to nuts, 10 years of investments that could be made really in all the different streams.
Yeah.
For the utility, all the different, touched everything. How does that compare? Because I would have thought if I said, what's your biggest success? It'd be the battery project.
Well, sure.
That you did.
Yeah, well, those were, you know, at the end where, you know, we, through, sort of happenstance, my tiny department ended up with the responsibility to quickly put together some very large utility scale battery projects back in 2016, 2017. And, you know, through, again, fortunate circumstances, really amazing executive support from our former boss, Jim Avery, we were able to pull together a 150 megawatt hour deployment at two different sites in a little under 8 months from sort of the concept and site identification to the COD.
Biggest in the world at the time?
Biggest in the world at the time, yeah. The Hornsdale battery in South Australia is 9 megawatt hours larger than the one that we have here in Escondido. I think that was an Elon Musk sort of nudge to get their project over the top to be the biggest in the world. But, you know, for the few weeks that you know, we had it, we were certainly very proud of that metric.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
When you look down the road, what's your vision for the future for climate mitigation? You can focus on electric transportation if you want.
Well, I think that, you know, we're very close to solving the energy storage problem. And, you know, it was literally from the discovery of electricity up until a few years ago that you couldn't really cost effectively store large amounts of electricity for later use. And it's looking like that problem might be solved, at least for short duration applications through electric vehicles and, you know, smaller stationary batteries. And there's a lot of promising technologies that are out there looking at the long-term stuff, whether that's, you know, sort of weeks or seasons or even years. And to me, that is really what unlocks a completely renewable intermittent electricity system. And it unlocks a method to convert our transportation systems to electricity without losing some of the storage reliability aspects that are really absolutely crucial to making it work on electric.
Ballard did a study that if the ZEV was successful and transportation was clean, that would double the amount of energy that would have to be get to the endpoints in some way. And that would be very hard with today's grid to double the amounts, especially at the locations where it might be necessary that maybe it isn't necessary today. Mm-hmm. So how do you see that getting solved?
Well, I think it depends on where you sit. I think that if you're, you know, in an executive office at an investor-owned utility in California, you see that as a rate base bonanza potential, that the idea that throughput could go up two or three or four times with the electrification of everything means that the, you know, these rate regulated infrastructure providers would have increased opportunities to, you know, invest in hardening the grid and adding capacity and things like that. So I think that, you know, the utility managers find that very exciting, and that, you know, they may be wrong about their role in how that's all going to work. I really think that we're going to become much more efficient at using the resources that we have, and that the standard utility practice of, you know, overbuilding and, you know, physically overbuilding infrastructure to accommodate sort of the worst fears in the worst year of the worst century.
Well, one of the biggest things, the biggest things are reliability and safety, so that you can understand that tendency.
Oh, I can. I can understand the tendency, but I also understand, at least here in San Diego, that we're paying the highest rates for electricity probably in the world. I'm not sure that there's anybody else that's paying higher rates than we are.
That's one of the reasons that I think it's unlikely that we're going to double the size of the grid to solve the transportation problem.
I agree.
Because
it's too expensive.
People just can't pay that much more.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's too much cost shifting in that model, right? You know, the way that we socialize costs through utilities, and it's really in focus right now with the fires and inverse condemnation and things like that. I mean, you know, these are essentially ways to tax the community. And so, you know, we have to be really careful about the way that that's done.
I agree. I think it's going to be a very interesting future.
Indeed.
Seeing how that plays out. Speaking of my thoughts, do you have any questions for me?
Well, you know, I think that you teed up one to me that I thought was actually really interesting. I'll tee it back to you, which is, you know, where are your doubts? Where is this going to go wrong?
Well, I didn't say where is it going to go wrong. Now you're really...
And I mean sort of, you know, our pursuit of the climate solution, because it seems like it's getting worse every day.
So I will tell you where my doubts lie. It's actually not in the technology. It is not in politics, where I know a lot of people feel that politically it can change on a dime. That's in the US. It can also change on a dime in other countries, and it has. But overall, the world has an understanding that the climate is changing due to carbon in the atmosphere, whether carbon dioxide or methane. And most people that take the time to understand the data see that the fact that we're already heating up is causing things to defrost that haven't been defrosted in forever. And that is releasing carbon dioxide and methane that was made hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago that is now coming to add to the amount that humans are making. So my concern is that by the time we align everything, there'll be so much change that has already happened that we won't be able to put it back in the box.
Yeah.
That's my concern.
Do you think that we're already past the point where we can reduce carbon output and solve the problem, or do we need actually to start taking it out of the atmosphere?
I personally think we have to start taking it out of the atmosphere.
I do too.
One of the technologies that Kevin Segarra at SDG&E, the CEO of SDG&E now, he's involved at Salk Institute, where they're developing a plant that its root structure can store a lot of carbon in it, and it can keep it stored. You know, so sequester it for as long a term as you need. And he has some data that, depending on how much land you want to give this, it could take a significant amount of carbon out of the atmosphere. So there are things like that I'm hoping are being developed to help that way.
Yeah, me too. I think it's an all of the above kind of thing, right? You can't just try and take it out of the atmosphere. You can't just try and avoid putting it in. Right. It's too late.
I think it's not or, it's and all the way. Anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
I think that things are starting to change a little bit this year and right now, in terms of the attitudes, and I think ultimately it'll turn up as policy changes. You know, this last wildfire up in Northern California, where, you know, 88 people, I think, is the current death count, died because of a, you know, potentially electrically triggered fire, and, you know, really aggravated by climate change related, you know, environmental situations. That to me, I think is going to be the wake up call, at least here in California, to become much more aggressive with what you're doing, with what we're doing, beyond Senate Bill 100, 100% RPSs or carbon free, electricity systems.
Which does seem pretty serious.
It does seem pretty serious, and it's coming up pretty soon. 15 years is not a long time. I have learned in this business to actually get things to turn over. They're assets that last a really, really long time. But, 88 people getting killed in a single event and, 15 or 20 or $30 billion of liability stacking up in 1 year, to the point where, today PG&E had to announce their intention to declare bankruptcy again for the second time in 20 years. And Edison could have the same thing happen to them because of their liability risk. And there's no reason why any of the others couldn't have it happen too. But I really think that it's going to start to shift now. I think that even more than the expenses, even more than the bankruptcy, it's going to be that 88 people got killed in a really terrible, horrible way as a result, and that there were things that we could have done to prevent it.
Yeah, and I think that what the focus needs to shift to is prevention rather than dealing with it after it happens, because that bill is just going to be too high.
And it'll just keep getting bigger.
Yeah.
There's no reason to think it won't just keep getting drier and that we won't keep having more fires, that, there's just no end in sight.
And other, other weather-related events.
Yeah.
And issues all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to wrap it up, if you don't mind, and I'm going to wrap it up with a rap. Hey, Josh, I'm really happy to know you. I'm glad you interviewed in 2002. It's kind of cold outside. I should have offered you some porridge. You are Mr. Energy Storage. Hey, Josh, I'm your biggest fan. You made a crazy smarter deployment plan. That's not the only thing that you did. You are Mr. Vehicle to Grid.
Oh, my. Thank you for that. I'll cherish it.
Elon, I think Josh called you out on installing an extra 9 megawatt hours of energy storage in Australia just to take the number one spot from SDG&E. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Name the time and place, and I'll come talk to you about your perspective on climate change for a future installment of Climate Champions. You certainly are that. The work Josh is doing with charging infrastructure to leverage electric vehicles, not just as electric load that replaces oil with renewable electricity, but as highly flexible grid resources that are able to provide energy services to the grid, is extremely exciting and enables EVs to double down on their impact to climate change mitigation.